Okay, so welcome to Narkis. This Shabbat, the 25th of November, we are post-American Thanksgiving, and we're backtracking a bit. We're doing Leviticus 15 today. So Leviticus 15, 1 through 24, which is coupled with Hosea 6, 1 through 9, and Jeremiah 17, 14. Really some beautiful passages in the prophets, and not as apparently beautiful in Leviticus 15, but we'll see. So, let's see, we've got a quorum of six people here, that's good. Maybe we can start on the right, and we'll read through Leviticus 15, 1 through 24. Let's see, if everybody takes four verses, we'll cover in six people. Oh, here's even more. So go ahead and read the first four verses and just carry on down that way.
Leviticus 15, the first one. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any man has a discharge from his body, his discharge is unclean. And this shall be his uncleanness in regard to his discharge, whether his body runs with his discharge or his body is stopped up by his discharge. It is uncleanness. Every bed is unclean on which he who has the discharge lies, and everything on which he sits shall be unclean.
Whoever touches his bed is to wash his clothes and bathe himself in water. He will be unclean until evening. Whoever sits on anything the person with the discharge sat on is to wash his clothes and bathe himself in water. He will be unclean until evening. Anyone who touches the body of the person with the discharge is to wash his clothes and bathe himself in water. He will be unclean until evening. If the person with the discharge spits on someone who is clean, the latter is to wash his clothes and bathe himself in water. He will be unclean until evening.
Any Sabbath too on which he sits who has the issue is unclean. So everyone who touches what was under him shall be unclean until evening, and he who picks it up shall wash his clothes, take a water bath, and be unclean until evening. Anyone who touches the one with the discharge touches anyone with whom the one with discharge touches without having his hands or his feet, must wash his clothes, take a bath, and be unclean until evening. The pottery that he with the issue touches must be broken, and every wooden vessel must be rinsed with water.
Or you can go on to Gary if you have English there. But you're not going to keep reading?
On the eighth day, he shall take two turtle doves or two pigeons and come before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting and give them to the priest. The priest shall offer them. The one is a sin offering and the other is a burnt offering. Thus the priest shall make an expiation on his behalf as a discharge before the Lord. When a man has an emission of semen, he shall bathe his whole body in water and remain unclean as a leaving. All cloth or leather under the semen shall be washed in water and remain unclean until evening. And if a man has carnal relations with a woman, they shall bathe in water and remain unclean.
Do you have English there?
Yeah, when a woman has a discharge, she doesn't have a discharge of blood from her body, she is to be in her menstruation 7 days. If anyone touches her, will be unclean until evening. Anything she lies on during her menstruation will be unclean, and anything she sits on will be unclean. Anyone who touches her bed must wash his clothes, bath in water, bed in water, be unclean until evening. And
Okay. There's a petucha there. So we can stop reading at that point. Okay, so let's just recap what we've read a little bit before we go on to the prophets, because these are mostly technical things, and the prophets make it more metaphorical. So we'll deal with the literal technical first. As we know, we've been reading through all kinds of skin diseases, and specifically tzara'at, which we haven't been able to come up with a good translation for, because not only does it infect humans, but it infects garments, leather, linen, and walls. Presumably, the part between the stones that is made out of some type of earth or plaster, and so you could get some mold there. Obviously, there's mold on rocks as well, but this type of disease is specifically reddish or greenish, and then sometimes whitish. So the mold I'm used to seeing here in Jerusalem is what I would call more black. Yeah, Christmas, red and green. So we finished all those laws, and if you notice, the last verse includes... Look at verse 57 of chapter 14. Or 54, it says, "This is the law for all diseased infections." And then it just gives the recap.
Verse what?
Of verse 54 of chapter 14. "This is the law for all diseased infections, for skull, for the diseased garment, for the house, for the swelling, for the scab, and for the bright spot." And each of these are strange technical words in Hebrew. "To teach when something is unclean and when it is clean." And I think that's the point. Like one of the jobs of the priest is to be able to teach clean and unclean, the whole system, because not everybody can keep it in their mind. If you read in the Hebrew, "Beyom hatameh uveyom hataho," the day of uncleanness and the day of cleanness. Why is it important to know when you're clean or unclean? You can't go into the tabernacle or the temple in a state of ritual impurity. And what I've been trying to suggest all these weeks is that most people, most of the time, are in a state of ritual impurity. The only time you're not is when you specifically go out of your way to become clean, and that would be right before you go into the temple. So it's not that most of the time we're all clean and, oops, occasionally we're impure. Like, no, most of the time you're impure, and occasionally you're pure. And that's when you set yourself apart, you get yourself ready to go to the temple. So... Now, the Levites have extra standards. Yeah. A Levite can't marry a divorced woman, for instance, or a widow. So they have some extra restrictions on them that is above and beyond. Sure. A lot of Levites. Oh, yeah, you'd have to have a lot of Levites, absolutely. Because you can't sleep with your wife and the next day go to the temple. Unless, I guess, if you're going in at nighttime because you're unclean until evening, which is an interesting point to... I mean, that's when the day starts, right? Evening to evening. So, but most... Okay, so to recap, we've read these... We've moved from tzara'at, this infectious skin disease, and now we're going into what I would call the zav, the oozing. And there are different things that can ooze for different reasons. And what I would like to point out is some of these are natural, normal, occurring all the time, and others of them are more in a specialized, something's wrong, you're sick, something is causing an abnormality. It starts off with men, and I think it would do so simply because the priests attending to the temple are men, And so the laws, as I'm reading through it, the most specific it gets is actually the beginning with the men's case. And then everything really follows suit. It's very systematic. So what is true for men is also true for women. The other interesting thing, who knows, did I give you the word I used? What word are we looking at in Hebrew? Has anyone heard this word before? Zav.
Yeah.
So, zav.
It's
lazuv.
It's predominantly used with the land flowing with milk.
Yeah. So you've all heard that this is a land flowing with milk and honey? It's that verb, flowing or oozing. When I think of zav, I think of more thick flowing, like oozing. But there are a couple times when it appears with water, which isn't particularly thick. So
right,
you could say flowing.
A rock flowed with water and God sent water from the rock. It appears twice.
However, that, I don't think it uses lazuv in the original story. It uses it in the retelling in Psalms. I think both the Psalm 105 and Psalm 78. Though there's also a place in Isaiah 48, I think,
Psalm
that uses lazuv.
Psalm 78,
uh-huh.
Ezekiel 20,
and
Ezekiel
20. No, there's another place. Isaiah 48.
Yeah.
Isaiah 48. So there's a couple places where it's used poetically of water, but mostly this verb is something I would translate as oozing. And I guess oozing doesn't sound as nice as flowing. So a land flowing with milk and honey instead of oozing with milk and honey. So it's interesting. Really, most of the context in the Bible talking about oozing, it's milk and honey, and it's a positive thing, right? It's a promise.
And the water from the rock.
And water from the rock.
It's like 95% positive.
Right. And then you have Leviticus, where it's all body oozing. And specifically, you have a euphemism. Everyone knows the word euphemism? When you speak around something that's uncomfortable to talk about. So in verse 2, it says, any man who is oozing from his flesh, basar. So anytime you see flesh, it could be several things. It could be your body. But specifically here, it's a euphemism for his male member. And we have the same euphemism in Qumran. You can be expelled from the Qumran community if you show your male member in public. And you know, they're not talking there about just showing your ankle. They're basar. Zebasar sham. I'm going off my memory, so I'd have to do some more searching to give you the exact reference, but I'm confident it's there because I read it at one point in my life. But the whole point is they're using a euphemism, flesh, for a specific body part. But it's interesting because euphemisms are by nature non-specific because you're talking around something. This same word is, in fact, used for the whole body, apparently, later on the passage. But, I mean, I guess you could argue there it's also a euphemism. Because if anyone touches his basar, they're unclean too. So does that mean if someone has some kind of emission that makes them unclean, if I then touch like that, am I unclean? Or is it only if you make contact with the part that's unclean that you're unclean? So I would say they're still both up for interpretation. So it goes into detail. Like, look at verse 3. It's fairly detailed. It looks like some type of infection because this oozing can either be coming out or it can be blocked up. And use the word hechtim. Hechtim saro. Like chotam is a seal, but it's like blocked up. So whether this oozing is actually literally oozing or should be oozing, but it's blocked inside, it still counts as oozing. So it's kind of a very particular differentiation. And trying to cover all circumstances of what this might mean. And so anything he lies on will be unclean. Any article that he sits on, any kind of furniture, it uses the word kli, just any kind of utensil he sits on will be unclean. Anyone who then touches his bed has to wash his clothes, and he'll be unclean until evening. So this uncleanliness transfers, it's contagious, and in that way it's slightly reminiscent of the leprosy. Because not all uncleanliness is contagious on that level. Okay, and you have to wash your clothes and dip in water and you'll be unclean till evening. Okay, so earlier I was referring to verse 7, that the one who touches his basar, his flesh, will have to wash their clothes and wash their bathe and be unclean till evening. So then the question is, are we dealing with close to the area that's actually unclean, or just anywhere on his skin and it transfers? But then verse 8, what did you think of verse 8? Very, very strange, huh? Because the reason I say it's strange is it's so specific. Anyone that this person with this emission spits on is unclean. So, yeah. And then later, you have a comment on it?
Just how would they know unless he tells them? And if he spat on them, he's unlikely to tell them.
Well, I guess, and why is he spitting on them? Like, it's kind of a strange thing. Although we have the reference in, is it Numbers 12, when God says, God punishes Miriam for speaking badly about Moses. And he says, and he gives her tzara'at for a week. And then when they're complaining, he said, isn't it like a father who punishes his children if he spits on them? And so there's that. Maybe it was used more commonly as a kind of punishment. I don't know. It's not something... I don't punish my kids by spitting on them. So it's kind of a cultural thing. But it's very interesting because it is so specific. So you're dealing with a lot of very fine-tuned details when we start out with the case of the man. And maybe it's because spit is also a thicker kind of fluid coming out of that person that they're trying to make a category. They're trying to be consistent. Mm-hmm. And so, if he's oozing, then spit is coming out of him. That would also be unclean, and so that needs to be part of this category.
What he does say, though, is that in the culture, they would spit on each other.
Yeah, exactly. Because why would they make the rule if it wasn't applicable?
Right.
Or if it only happened once in a lifetime, it wouldn't, you know, wouldn't make the... We could all be spitting on each other.
Isn't it like there's a kind of infection? They know it, that it's going to be...
It seems... It's certainly... In this first starting case, it seems to be an infection... Something that's abnormal. This is not just normal.
So maybe it's not so much disgust. You know, you think of that as kind of the ultimate insult.
Spitting?
Maybe it was more, I don't like what you're doing.
Yeah, a corrective. Okay, so now we're going to, now you bring it up, now we got to go to Numbers. Okay, let's go to Numbers 12. Miriam was leprous. Okay, so if you look at Numbers 12:13, this is when Moses is pleading on Miriam's behalf, who has just spoken against him. Actually, Aaron also in verse 12, don't let her be like a baby born dead, whose flesh is half consumed when it comes out of its mother's womb. Then Moses cried to the Lord, I'm reading from verse 13 of chapter 12 of Numbers, heal her now, O God. The Lord said to Moses, if her father had only spit in her face, would she not have been disgraced for 7 days? Shut her out from the camp 7 days, and afterwards she can be brought back in again. Okay.
And she publicly spit. So then maybe it is more.
Okay, Okay, so God, in his answer to Moses, is using a metaphor or something that happens in daily life to help Moses understand the situation. And so he mentions this custom that we really don't have elsewhere in the Bible. And he refers to it rhetorically, like, isn't this the case? Don't you know that when this happens, this happens? And I'm reading it, and I was like, no, I didn't know that.
Yes, he has also known from 25.
Okay. Oh, right, she spits on the sandal. Okay. So there is this spitting that's going on, that's expressing things culturally, that is a sign of, I would say, correction. I don't know if we want to make a broad category of when do you spit on someone?
I mean, correction or just kind of just anger? I don't.
Okay, well, in the case of Moses, if her father had only spit in her face.
Publicly.
Yours says publicly, but it doesn't actually say that. It doesn't say that in the Bible. However, if you connect it to Deuteronomy, where the widow was supposed to be married by the brother, and the brother refuses, she goes to a public place, like the city gate. He takes off the sandal, and she spits on him. So it is public there. So maybe in the case of the father and the child, it's also public.
Because back in Deuteronomy 25, it's the foot, the sandal, right? Because everyone knows in the Middle East, the shoe is unclean and disrespectful. And so, like, you had that with Ruth, with Boaz at the city gate, where the other guy took off the shoe and gave it to her. He did this Deuteronomy 25 thing, but he didn't spit.
Yeah.
Right? But it's from this that he should have taken care of Naomi, but
he did it. It's economically taxing.
Yeah. It's a voice.
Interesting. He loosens his sandal from his foot, so he's to get his sandal.
Yeah. And if you notice in Numbers 14, she will be disgraced 7 days. So there's no tame, there's no uncleanliness here. It's a metaphorical be disgraced. So whatever that means. She'll carry around some type of disgrace for 7 days.
I will tell you, it's just from a personal story that I was getting on a bus and there was this group of kids over by the first station, and apparently the bus driver knew them, they knew him, they were cursing him out, he was cursing them out, and I was just trying to get on the bus, and then this one kid out there got ready. The driver saw what he's doing, and he like that, and he like spit through the door, and it hit me in the eye.
Oh no!
And it was like, and you couldn't do anything about it. It just like went straight into my head, you know. It's like you could, anyways. It's
what did he say?
No. It was started. They're all cursing each other. He closed the door right, you know, when he was doing it. So it was. They were off the bus, and so he really got a good distance on it. So, anyways, you get spit on, it's like you're just like,
it's being put in your place somehow. It's not a positive thing.
Especially in the face.
Well, here in Numbers, it's referring to the face.
I know, it's like getting spit in the face.
It's humiliating and gross.
In some cultures, it is offense under law to spit at somebody.
Well, here it seems it's an insult, but it seems like there is an appropriate time. Like when God mentions the father doing it to a child, it seems like he's very unhappy with something the kid did, and it's a result, it's a consequence of bringing shame on the family, maybe, or doing something terribly wrong. You spit on them, and then their disgrace is kind of like judgment. So in a priest, if you're thinking about this in terms of priests, I don't know, would a higher priest spit on a lower priest when they've done something wrong? Was it a type of legitimate correction thing, or is this just in the case when people are having a disagreement and someone's mad at the other and spits on them?
Yeah,
I don't know. But they have a rule for when this happens. Yeah.
The examples are pretty
important. And if he spits on someone who is clean, that person has to wash their clothes and rinse themselves and be unclean until evening. And when he rides, in verse 9, if he rides on something like a donkey or whatever, that's going to be unclean. So very detailed description. And in verse 11, notice everything or person that this unclean man touches will, without washed hands, will be unclean. So there's kind of, there's levels of uncleanliness. Like anything he lies on or sits on is automatically unclean. But then everything else, let's say he's in the kitchen, he's trying to help his wife make dinner. As long as he washes his hands, it's okay. But if he doesn't wash his hands, you got to break every pot he touches, right? Every clay pot in verse 12, it has to be broken. But the wooden things you can wash with water. So again, very detailed instructions. And when there's very detailed instructions, it means this is practically relevant. And so from the perspective of Vayikra, you're coming up with all these rules, I can see how the priests particularly would need to know very detailed conditions for when they are in a fit place to go to the temple and when they're not. And notice in verse 13, what happens when he becomes clean? He has to count how many days?
Seven. It sounds exactly like after the woman gives birth, like Mary.
Yeah. It sounds the same way as childbirth.
Childbirth, yeah, the two pigeon doves.
Uh-huh, very similar. So he has to count out 7 days, wash his clothes in living water. He has to rinse himself in living water. So later on, they came up with mikvaot as a form of living water that is more accessible than going down to a stream or a river or something, and he'll be clean. And then on the seventh day, he takes his birds to the temple. And Amos's translation said one bird was for sin offering. Or was that yours, Nick? It's a hatat again. I prefer to use a purification offering because here we're not dealing with anything sinful. Lechate is also to purify. So the question is hatat coming from the word chata'a, sin, or lechate, purify, and I would say it's purification.
One last footnote before you skip verse 12 about the clay vessel.
Well, I mentioned it, but yeah.
Oh, sorry. Well, so that's why later on in the second temple period of Judaism,
you use stone.
They start using stone, like in John 2, when Jesus went away in Cana, they had stone jars or stone pots for the wine and the water.
Because stone was interpreted to be impervious to uncleanliness.
So here you're supposed to break it with the clay.
So like a lizard, if a lizard falls in a clay pot, you have to smash the pot and it ruins everything in the pot. But if it's a stone jar, you just take out the lizard.
But stone is more expensive, and so you can make sure rich people have it.
Or more of it, maybe. And also notice here in verse 12, wood is also considered different. Yeah, you don't have to burn it or destroy it. You just have to wash it. However, you probably aren't making your pots out of wood. So that would refer more to chairs and tables or benches, anything else you'd sit on. Yeah, there is an atonement. You're right. And the question, question is what that whole concept is. And does it have to be sin to be atoned for? Because in my mind, it seems like atonement also includes bringing wholeness again. And so, like, sin is a metaphorical brokenness, and to atone for something, you're making it whole again. But in the physical realm, like, if you're sick, it's not a sin, it's not morally sinful, but you need to be brought to wholeness. And so I think, I'm not an expert on these whole terms, but I think that atonement also can refer to a, outside the moral area, a wholeness. Certainly the worldview of priests and the whole concept of purity and impurity is also connected to life and wholeness and death and brokenness on a metaphorical side. And that's why, you know, in the laws of priests, if you're physically damaged, you're not allowed to serve in the temple. Well, why not? What did that person do? Is he any more sinful than someone else? No. But he represents in his body a lack of wholeness, and so he's not supposed to be a candidate for representing God, who is whole, complete, holy. And so I think for those reasons, we come at it all through just a moral perspective and a very metaphorical one, but I think it was broader, and it involved physical, complete wholeness, and it wasn't an evil thing to be impure. And it wasn't, I mean, obviously all humans are fallen, whatever, but Jesus was impure. Mary brought her two doves after childbirth. So childbirth blood causes impurity both to the woman and anyone who touches. So Jesus would have been impure. So it's not a sin to become impure. It's a sin not to deal with it according to the law. If you don't rinse yourself and bring the appropriate thing, that would be the sinful thing, because then you're just ignoring God's commands. But the state of becoming impure, I mean, you're told in Genesis 1, be fruitful and multiply. Well, every time you try to do that, you will become impure. So even in the blessing, it's understood you're going to become impure. But you're just supposed to take a shower, and you'll be impure until evening. And in the case, if you're going to the temple, well, then refrain. Okay, so then we come to... So we finished at the end of verse 15. There's a little paragraph break that goes way back. It's a stuma, so it's a small paragraph break. In the Bible, they had big paragraph breaks and small paragraph breaks. And these breaks, if I remember right, even predate the division into verses. So they're little section markers. Verse 16 is like a subcategory then. All of a sudden, we have something new. It brings up the case of a man who comes out from him in emission of semen. So presumably, this is outside of his intentions. It just happened to him. Let's say he's just sleeping at night and it just happens. So in this case, it's something normal. It's not a disease, right? However, because it happened, it's still in the category of, you know, this falls outside. I mean, this still creates the same situation of uncleanliness. So it gives a rule for it. You rinse in water all your flesh. And again, is it just that area or all your flesh? Presumably your whole body, I don't know. And you're unclean till evening. So no big deal. You just need a rule to know what to do in that situation. And every clothes item he touches or leather that's on him at the time has to be washed, and it will be unclean till evening. All right, so then that's your major division. Then you have a paragraph mark there. So far we've covered everything that has to do with a man, all kinds of emissions that would cause him to be unclean. And I would say they start with one that's considered to be more abnormal, like the sick, and then they toss in the normal, like, okay, well, this can also just normally happen. And notice the difference, I would point out. The one that's actual a sickness, there's he counts off 7 days. And the one that's just normal, you're just unclean till evening. So then verse 18 starts with a woman. Oh, wait, no. Okay, yeah, it does start with a woman, but it's still talking from the man's perspective. A woman that he sleeps with, now they're both unclean. Again, this is just regular life, right? You sleep with your wife, you're both unclean until evening. Then, because he's brought in woman, now verse 19, he continues with a woman. If she is oozing somehow, and then it then defines that more, blood is her oozing out of her, again, use the same euphemism, flesh. 7 days will be her nida. Now, nida is specifically the term used for menstruation in the Bible. Menstrual impurity here. So, Leviticus, I think, just, you need categories, you need borders, and every woman's body might be different, but we just have to determine how long this is going to be. 7's a good number. 7 might be average, I don't know. But we're just going to say 7 days, she is going to be impure. What I don't know is why they add 7 days on top of this 7, but we'll get to that in a minute. And I'm referring to Jewish halakha here, not just the text. Everyone who touches her will be unclean until evening, the same way as everything else before. So here it's bringing up, because we brought up the woman, it's bringing up another situation. So far, this is normal, right? This is just something that happens normally. And then everything she lies on during her menstruation will be unclean, everything she sits on, exactly the same way as we had for the man above, even though that was his abnormal state. And everyone who touches what she sat on has to wash and be unclean till evening. Let's skip down to 24. Okay, so verse 24. Now again, this is from a man's perspective. Think again of a Levite and his own wife. If a man happens to sleep with her when she's unclean, now what do you do? Presumably this was unintentional, and so then he becomes unclean for 7 days. Also similar to the way was stated before. Where was that? He becomes unclean 7 days. It's a little...
Lies inside her covers, touching her and also sleeping.
Lies be...
Covers, touching her, or sex.
Yeah, the impurity for sleeping with her while she has any type of menstrual signs is much stronger. You notice you're impure for 7 days, as opposed to if you just regularly sleep with your wife, you're impure for 1 day. So there's a sense of you're not supposed to do this, and if you do, there's a bigger impurity time.
Can you imagine the practicality of this priest? I mean, okay, I'm out. Yeah. Next guy. Okay, I'm out too. Maybe.
Yeah. It's very.
It's so invasive.
Yes.
Information.
It is. And you'd have to be very careful to follow. Like a lot of these things, only the priest himself would know,
right.
He and his wife. So he has to be very honest.
Plus, every time you saw people going out and spontaneously doing laundry.
Yeah, like so. But again, this is my point. Everyone is always impure. That's the normal life. And so every time, right? Every time you go to the temple, you better wash your clothes and rinse yourself, because there's all kinds of things that could have made you impure. Okay, so then it goes into a case after the normal, and the what do you do in this situation? Then you have in verse 25 following exceptional bleeding, and you can think of Luke So Luke 8, the woman who's been bleeding for a long time. Imagine what she was. She has been unclean and ostracized for 12 years. She has not been able to go to the temple for 12 years. I mean, imagine the desperation she feels. I mean, it's amazing.
To be cut off from
everything. And specifically in that story, what happens? What does she do to Jesus? She touches him. So technically, she's transferring her uncleanliness, which should make him unclean for 7 days.
His clothing.
Well, she touched the tzitzit, the hem of his garment. So technically, I guess he should wash his garment, and he would be, I don't know, would he be unclean for 7 days or 1 day? But it seems that Jesus doesn't even worry about that, because the power of his cleanliness seems to trump hers, her uncleanliness. There seems to be some kind of a trump he has. I'm not talking about the American president here. Okay.
Spoiled.
I know, the word spoiled, isn't it?
Well, it kind of goes into the Hosea passage.
Yeah. Okay, so I just want to point out one thing. In verse 28, you see the same thing. In this exceptional bleeding, she has to, when it's over, she has to count 7 days, and after that she'll be pure. And on the seventh day, she brings the same offerings. So extended bleeding, extended emission, these things. And I guess childbirth is a normal thing, but it falls under this category of extended bleeding. So you have the same thing where you wait a certain amount of days and then you bring a sacrifice. But I would say the normal stuff, just sleeping with your wife, you're just unclean till evening. Just a menstrual period, you're unclean 7 days. Somehow, verse 29 or 28, 29... in Jewish halakha has been connected to the normal menstruation. I don't know why, because as I read the text, this is for the exceptional. Because otherwise, you know, half of every month you're unclean, and that just doesn't make sense to me. Yeah. So, but look at the results. 31. Warn the children of Israel in their impurity, so that they don't die in their impurity if they come to the tabernacle. So the whole point is so that they don't incur on themselves the serious consequence of death if you appear in the Lord's holy place in an inappropriate state. And that's the whole point of this.
If the man fitness or whatever was killed, was in an impure state. Or
sure.
The guy who touched the tabernacle was in an impure state, which means it's kind of his fault rather than...
Right. And there it's mentioned strange fire. But yeah, if you come in a condition of anything that could make you impure, it could result in death. Okay, so that's our detailed law. Let's read Hosea. Hosea is going to take this whole image and make it metaphorical. And these are some of the beautiful things. Hosea 6, 1 through 9. I'll just read it. Okay. Well, I have to read verse 1 in Hebrew. Lechu v'nashuva el Adonai, ki hu taraf v'yirpa'enu, yach v'yach b'shenu. It's beautiful poetry. Taraf, you hear the resh and the pe. Yirpa, you have a resh pe. So they're... Taraf is what an animal does when it attacks and it kills
prey.
Yeah, like a lion, toref. He rips his prey apart. Yirpa, he will heal. So he ripped us apart and he will heal us. Yach is actually let him strike or hit. And yach beshenu is he will wrap us up. So you have... nice poetry linking two opposite words together. So here it seems like Hosea is painting this picture that this is a case where it's actually punishment. Whatever kind of sickness has happened to them is as a punishment. God is ultimately allowing it, and he's the one that will fix it again. So he has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bandage our wounds. And then he will restore us in a very short time. He will heal us in a little while, so that we may live in his presence. Oh, wow. They just totally took out. In Hebrew it says, from 2 days, on the third day he will raise us up. So, again, if you think of poetry in two halves, you can have one half complement the other. Sometimes you have numerical ladders, three, even four, two to three here. I personally always think of the slave. You remember the Israelite slave? If you kill a slave, you're guilty. If you kill an Israelite slave, you're guilty of bloodshed if he dies on the spot. But if he gets up after 2 days, it's okay. Remember that law? So that's the law I always think of. On the third day, he gets up. So like God has punished us as servants of God, we've been punished, but he didn't kill us. He, you know, we're getting up on the third day, and we're going to live before him. Like now, we're going to learn to really do the right thing. And of course, the third day, getting up on the third day, has nice ties to the New Testament as well. But there, it would be Jesus filling in for the for Israel, basically taking the sins or the punishment of Israel and then getting up on the third day, or the punishment of the world by extension. Okay, so let's keep reading. We may live in his presence, so let us acknowledge him. Let us seek to acknowledge the Lord. He will come to our rescue as certainly as the appearance of the dawn, as certainly as the winter rain comes, and that's Geshem, as certainly as the spring rain that waters the land, Malkosh. What am I going to do with you, O Ephraim? What am I going to do with you, O Yehuda? For your faithfulness is as fleeting as the morning mist. It disappears as quickly as dawn's dew. Therefore, I will certainly cut you into pieces at the hands of the prophets. These verses are a little difficult. Uses the word lahtsov. To cut to pieces here is lahtsov, and it's what we do to stone. Like when you dig a grape, a wine press, you dig it in the stone, you chotsev. And it says, al ken chatzavti banvi'im. I have dug in to the prophets or by the prophets, depending how you interpret it. And I think he's saying by the prophets. Haragtim be'imrei fi, because I have killed them with the words of my mouth. Or I will certainly kill you in fulfillment of my oracles of judgment. For my judgment will come forth like the light of dawn. For I delight in faithfulness, not simply in sacrifice. I delight in acknowledging God, not simply in whole burnt offerings. At Adam, they broke the covenant. Oh, how they were unfaithful to me. Gilad is a city full of evildoers. Its streets are stained with bloody footprints. The company of priests is like a gang of robbers, lying in ambush to pounce on a victim. They commit murder on the road to Shechem. They have done heinous crimes. So this is a critique of society, but particularly priests are mentioned here as well. So that's an interesting tie-in with our verse. What do you see that could connect these two things? It's a little difficult, yeah?
Wait, what?
What do you see that would connect this Hosea passage with Leviticus 15?
I actually see the New Testament as the key to it.
Okay. Bring us a which part?
The woman with the blood.
Woman with the blood.
She's been here for 12 years.
Uh-huh.
And it says she's got this blood flow. So it's the same word that Leviticus 15 is talking about. The Zav.
Mm-hmm.
Or Zava. And then it says when she touches Jesus' thing, it says she's saved.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Says you've been healed.
Yes.
And if you look in Jeremiah 17:14, it says,
the erape.
Which Hosea 6.
Boshi eni ve'ivashea. So should we read that really quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Jeremiah 17, because these are also beautiful, beautiful verses.
Because it's weird, like, why would a woman of 12 years need to be saved? Right? She just needs her blood to stop flowing.
Well, here's the thing. The concept of salvation in Old Testament, when it uses the word saved, it means solution to a problem.
Right.
Now, it could be a big overall arching problem, like all humanity is broken, needs a big solution, that kind of salvation, and that's where evangelicals go first. But it also includes little problems, like I'm sick and I need this, I need to get better. And so you can get salvation for that problem, or, you know, my sink is leaking, I need salvation. So salvation is a solution. And I think the woman with the blood, she needed the blood to stop flowing, right? And so that was her salvation. Okay, so Jeremiah 17:14. Refa'eni Adonai ve'erafe. Heal me and I will be healed. Hoshi'eni ve'ivashea. Save me and I will be saved.
So if you were to look at, say, like Mark 5:25, you may read it?
Sure.
Now there was a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage, which literally says a flow of blood, for 12 years. Right? And Hosea 6 says, in a short time, or in so much time, God's going to do something. So in her case, it's 12 years. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She endured a great deal in the care of many doctors and spent all that she had. And instead of being better, she grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him. So, in Hosea, it says that your chesed is so not chesed. You know, you're faithless people. You're like, you gave up. You're not.
Or you're superficial.
But you're not pursuing, you're not trusting that God's going at some point to heal you and to save you. Whereas this woman, 12 years later, she's still trying.
She
has faith. Yeah, she's still trying.
And she's initiating something that she thinks she believes that that's going to help.
Jesus did not come to her house.
No, exactly. She went out and touched him.
Yeah. So, anyways, it says, when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd, touched his cloak, for she kept saying, if I only touch his clothes, I will be healed. And, you know, the whole thing about the CCO. Once the flow for the bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. So there's the word heal, which is what you have in Hosea and Jeremiah. Jesus knew at once that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? His disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing against you, and you say, who touched me? But he looked around to see who had done it. Then the woman with fear and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. But actually, in the Greek, it says there, your faith has saved you.
Has saved you, yeah.
Saved you. So you have a saved part of Jeremiah.
And as we see in Jeremiah and Hosea, these come in parallel. To be healed and to be saved are often parallel in the Hebrew Bible. So whether you're talking about morally, being healed morally and saved, or physically, they're often in parallel. And so it's
Jesus
a nice...
Jesus reverses that. I mean, you know, he also, when they ask for healing, he saves first and then heals.
Yeah, yeah. So really he plays with that concept. He says, which is harder? I'm going to do the hardest thing first and then the easy. Like the physical is the seal of what I've already done morally. Yeah, it's interesting.
Also, this idea the woman has that the clothes are synonymous with the person, which is for healing, which is the reversal of the clothes become impure if the body has a problem.
Yeah, so on a physical level, the clothes become impure, and that impurity can pass on to other people. Mm-hmm. And then she's taking that, reversing it, so the clothes, particularly the tassel. Because the hem of the garment represents following God's commandments. It represents the character of that person. So when she's grabbing on the tassel, she's kind of acknowledging who Jesus is. Like you, it's not just anybody's tassel, it's Jesus' tassel. Because he is the righteous and pure person that would actually have the power to transfer to her, basically.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of other times when what people are clothed in is very important.
Yeah.
Like in Revelation and fine linen. And there is
if you look in Isaiah, particularly the end of Isaiah, elsewhere in the prophets, what you're wearing is your actions, what you've been doing. Your justice or your injustice really clothes you. And so I think that is also key to understanding both the parables of the wedding banquet in Matthew, elsewhere in the Gospels, and Revelation, that what you wear is, or metaphorically, it's what you do. And that ties again to this concept of the tassels, maybe. You remind me of something else I was going to say, and I forgot. Maybe it wasn't that important. No. So I guess we're out of time. Does anyone have a burning thought they haven't spoken?
Well, I see that as they can get clean if they follow the law.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in this Hosea, if we will be honest, then God will forgive us. And that
mm-hmm.
I really like the verse 6, where it said that I have a. I like, it's very special, I like, for I delight in faithfulness, not simply in sacrifice, I delight in acknowledging God, not simply in whole burnt offerings.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, the broke the covenant, and his
mm-hmm.
that.
Absolutely, because it makes you think, like, these people are trying to follow the commandments, but if you're not doing it from the right motives,
yeah.
it's meaningless. Like, these are all rituals, but the rituals stand for something, and it has to mean something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you get married and exchange a ring, but then you're out going around with other women, well, that's not really, it's meaningless then. Who cares if you gave a ring? Like, you have to, sure, give the ring, but it has to come with intentions behind it and actions that come from a very deep level. So, yeah, it's the intentions that matter in all of this stuff.
And Jesus quoted that verse a lot too.
Yeah.
Hosea 6:6.
I was thinking of Psalm 51, David's prayer
mm-hmm.
of repentance,
mm-hmm.
and it has a number of verses. And in sin, my mother conceived me.
Mm-hmm.
And the bones of your broken name rejoice. And then restore to me the joy of your salvation.
Yeah.
To be a whole,
yeah, the salvation
process going on, which in some way mirrors what we've been.
Yeah, absolutely.
At.
Yeah. And kabseni, it says, like wash me, which is exactly what you're supposed to do to your garments
yes.
that have become
yes.
become unclean.
Yes.
But in here, he's doing it metaphorically. Wash me of my iniquity, and of my sin. Make purify me. So he's now taking these purification laws and having them a metaphor for sin.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the question is verse 5 only about David or is it about all of us? I think most of us take it as all of humanity. But there are some who take it to be of David himself. But that's a whole other interesting Bible study. Okay, I'm getting the signs. Time to wrap up. So, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
May we be honest and with good intentions in our actions.
Thank you.
And if you can make your way downstairs, the service is just ready to start.